Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and as you know, here at Bruegel, we are closely following the research agenda on the future of work. As part of this effort, we are one of the facilitators, together with the German Marshall Fund, of the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future of Work, which is an interdisciplinary group of some 30 knowledgeable and highly qualified experts from both sides of the Atlantic, and the project is funded by the European Union. The aim of the group is to explore multiple emerging challenges in the area of the future of work by bringing together their respective perspectives from the European Union and the USA. The Sound of Economics is proud to contribute to the project with a space for discussion and analysis on this theme. And I'm happy to be accompanied today for this by Scott Marcus, who is a senior fellow here at Bruegel. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Just fine. It's a beautiful sunny day here in Bonn, Germany, Giuseppe.
Amazing. Here in Brussels, too. And today we would like to go into one of the topics you are discussing in the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future of Work, which touches a lot of us. I refer to working from home and the great transition we might be assisting towards a new landscape of hybrid work, which has been open during the pandemic, but could now evolve further and in many ways. Scott, you have written a paper on the topic, the link is in the show notes for our listeners, looking particularly at the EU and the USA. We're going to dive more into it in a second, because I would like to introduce our guest for today's episode, Lisette Soderlund, who is also a member of the Transatlantic Expert Group. Lisette, hi. How are you?
It's good. It's also a very beautiful sunny day here in the Netherlands, much needed after a long dark winter.
Great. And Lisette, you are remote working German-born American, as you say, living in the Netherlands. You are totally jazzed by the fact that it's possible to work from anywhere. Actually, that is the title of the handbook that you authored, Work Together Everywhere. A handbook on working remotely successfully for individuals, teams, and managers. So you are the perfect match to couple Scott in this conversation today.
Right. I'm a transatlantic remote worker, indeed.
Exactly. You are a living example of the subject matter of this conversation, basically.
Exactly.
So I'm looking forward to hear from you and Scott, and you definitely have an inspirational and practical approach to this. But first things first, I would like to ask Scott to set the scene and give us a short backgrounder of where do we stand 2 years from the beginning of the pandemic on the landscape of remote working, with a particular comparison to the two sides of the Atlantic. Scott, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Giuseppe. I think to begin with, it's important to remember that working from home or remote work isn't entirely new. It's been around for a long time. And in fact, not only Lisette, but also I am a transatlantic remote worker and was one even before the pandemic. So people have been doing this for a long time, but it was transformed in very fundamental ways by the pandemic. In the historic past, it was often treated more as an employee benefit for highly skilled or highly paid workers. And in that mode, it was gradually growing over time, but the growth was indeed very gradual. What was actually less common was for people to be spending all of their time working from home, and that also was not growing very much at all. So what the pandemic did was really to force a lot of us to do work from home, a lot of us who previously hadn't had the opportunity to do it. And that was a big change. Now, one might well ask, why did this suddenly happen and why now? And why didn't it happen earlier in particular? That's not a question of technology. Most of the technologies that we use for working from home were already around in various forms. Zoom isn't brand new, WebEx, all of the rest, all of these conferencing tools, they were around, but they weren't as much used. What the survey data tell us is that workers who had the opportunity to work from home generally very much appreciated the flexibility that it gave them. But employers were nervous. They were nervous about a loss of productivity. They were nervous about a loss of control. They weren't sure that their workers would really be working, and they weren't sure that they would know whether their workers were working. So they were reluctant. And there were also institutional rigidities, stiffness in the way we were set up, that got in the way. So what changed is that we were forced to do it. The companies had no choice for workers who were actually able to work from home. And what we found is that when we had to do it, we could. And that's very transformative. Things are not likely to go back exactly to where they were. Things will go back to some kind of normal, but it won't be the old normal. It will be a new normal. And part of that new normal is likely to be that instead of working every day at the office, a lot of us will work 2 days, 3 days in the office and the rest of the time at home. That's pretty clear in survey results on both sides of the Atlantic. That seems to be the preferred mode. And the employers seem to have figured out that they can work with that, and that it gives a reasonable blend or balance between being able to keep teams on track and yet still give employees free time, reduce costs, provide many benefits. As far as productivity, historically, there was a very strong belief that people had to be physically sitting in one place to do this. Office design, many other institutions in the way things were managed reflected that. But actually, the evidence for that was never all that strong. Many of us, myself included, were doing remote work with intercontinental teams, you know, years ago, long before we were forced to. And so again, what we see, it is possible. We know now that it can be done, and we're going to be doing more of it going forward. The question of when we return to something looking like it, some kind of normal, that of course is still open. But it's clear that even when we're not forced to work from home, a lot of people will wish to and almost certainly will be allowed to.
Scott, you argue in your paper that among the barriers to previous adoption, but even to the change of the approach to work location now after these years of experiences, tests, and widespread evidence, as you mentioned, of the possibility of successfully working remotely, you say that the inability to modernize work pattern has slowed down the implementation of a more trusting and more results-based management. I would like to ask Lisette, as she has been observing such challenge in modernizing the working culture. How do you see that, Lisette? Also, are we observing differences between the USA and Europe on that regard, on this modernization process and on this cultural change?
I personally am not noticing a difference between the US and the EU in terms of what people are challenged with or what companies in particular are challenged with. And what I see across the board is that people have taken what we did, the workflow processes and the systems that we had in person, and because of the pandemic, we've translated those same systems online. And what we found is that they don't work because hybrid or remote has to be thought of as a new medium of work. And I like to make the analogy between radio and television. They're both broadcasting mediums, but you would design content for radio very differently than you design it for television. So the same now holds true in terms of our workflow processes and the way we work. All of those workflow processes need to be modernized and changed. And it's not that it's rocket science, but it does require attention and sort of deliberate behavior on the parts of both leaders and teams in order to do that. So, I mean, I think what we saw during the pandemic, right, is we took everything online and what everybody ended up with is endless online meetings and very full inboxes. And that's just, I think, one of the things that shows that we're doing it wrong because it's not a long-term sustainable way of working. During the pandemic, we dealt with it because we're all in survival mode. But as a long-term strategy, it's just not healthy to be having, you know, 20 plus hours of meetings virtually every week without breaks or just back-to-back meetings throughout the day, and these just endless, unstructured, and unscheduled emails. So in that regard, those are really the systems that need to be modernized now. And I don't see the difference transatlantic. I think all companies are dealing with it. I think the difference between the US and the EU sort of comes in different policy aspects in the way that people are dealing with it. But in terms of the way people are working, I see it sort of across the board the same, almost all over the world, really.
Scott, would you like to add something to this?
Well, I think Lisette really hit the nail on the head with all of her comments. What we've seen is some transformation in the way companies are operating, probably not enough. We'll need to see more. A key change is that productivity now, we need to think of not so much in terms of the number of hours that people work, but rather in terms of what they're getting done. Think of sort of a management by objectives kind of approach. What we actually see with productivity, by the way, there's actually a little evidence, not a lot, that people's productivity per hour, at least some people, may be a bit lower in work from home. I'm thinking especially of people who have caregiving responsibilities, children at home doing schoolwork, things like that. But most people are working, on average, about an hour more per day. And you can't say that that's necessarily at the expense of the worker, because they're probably saving more than that on commute time. So again, we need to rethink a lot of our institutions. The differences between US and Europe, I think, are less in the way this has played out to date. They're more in areas like how we actually look to enhancing skills. Our training approaches are different. I think we'll be looping back to that. And also especially in the implications and the implementation in public policy.
And Scott, I'm going to interrupt you here because we are going to get to this in a second. But basically, this was my next question to you, because you mentioned caretaking. There are other examples that are linked to the well-being of the workers in general, like new challenges which are emerging in the work-life balance in general, or the line between what a company can offer in all this. I mean, you just mentioned it. There are some fine lines over there. There are some parts which are dealing with management styles and how management can change their approaches. But there is also a part which is dealing with the policy framework, which is enabling the workers and the companies to operate in this new environment. So all these requires perhaps a further reflection on what is going to happen so far, you know, because at the moment, as Lisette said before, during the pandemic, this has been a sudden switch and somehow a survival mode that has been operated. But now, if there is a more long-term approach, this kind of more policy reflections on one side and management style changes will have to be a bit more permanent, correct?
Absolutely. What we're definitely seeing on the one hand is it puts stress on people, and this is going to play out somewhat differently in a post-pandemic period, whatever we want to think of as a post-pandemic period being, than it does during the pandemic. There are two dimensions of that I'd especially like to highlight. The first is the special strains that people at home with caregiving responsibilities, especially caregiving responsibilities for children, experience. Again, during the pandemic, not only the parents, but also the kids have been at home sharing limited workspaces. It's been a real stress. Lots of survey results show that people are burned out, people are stressed, people are tired. It's a serious issue. When we go back to a more normal setting, though, there may still be some echoes of this. A number of the survey results suggest that women, and especially women with caregiving responsibilities, have particularly suffered from various kinds of stress. And there's a concern that when we go back, that the women might actually, even though they benefit greatly from being able to work from home, they benefit enormously from that, but that also there may be a tendency for them to be overlooked for promotional opportunities, for training opportunities, for long-term benefits that might actually hurt the long-term equity of the workplace, even if it generates medium and short-term benefits. Now, a second dimension I'd like to flag has to do with the difficulty of separating private life from work life. All indications are that this has become much, much harder during the pandemic forced work-from-home shift. People are being constantly bombarded with email. I know I get emails at all hours of the day or night. You know, how do we shut this off? And this is almost certainly a question that public policy will have to deal with. A number of European member states have already implemented rules that create at least the beginning of a framework for a right to disconnect. The idea that if an employee wants to shut off his phone or his email or whatever outside of work hours, there should be a legal right to do that. Now, I think a lot of us might find it difficult to exercise that right, But it still makes sense to me that policymakers look at this. And again, I think with the implications longer term for caregivers, especially female caregivers, probably policy is going to need to look at that as well. It's less clear there what exactly policy can do about it.
Lizette, how do you react to this?
Yeah, there are two aspects when we go from in-person to remote, and there's sort of two different things that I wanted to address, and that is one from the individual perspective and then one from the leadership perspective in an organization. And I think in the case of well-being and work-life balance, from the individual perspective, the thing that needs to change most is that we have to be more conscientious and more deliberate about how we spend our time when we go remote. That means taking more breaks, more physical breaks, because we're spending way too much time in 2D. I mean, that's what we found. You know, in the office, we have a natural 3D barrier in all kinds of ways, right? We've got the 9-to-5 structure so that we come in and we leave on time. We've got sort of a 3D environment around us. When we're working from home, it's really a lot of screen time. And the thing that makes it so difficult, I think, for individual workers is that it's a matter of self-discipline. You can put all the policy in place that you want, but it really comes down to a self-responsibility of when am I on and when am I off? And in fact, in Cal Newport's book, Deep Work, which I really loved, he advises that we need to be on and off. So when we're on, we need to be working and focused and, you know, doing things. But when we're off, we really need to turn off and keep that barrier so that our brain gets rest. Most of us are knowledge workers in this space, and the brain needs some time to rest. Now, for leaders, there's a different perspective. Like for leaders who were working in person, we're able to lead in the past with charisma or with our personalities. We could inspire people through like inspiring talks and actions. That doesn't translate as well online. And what people are looking more for in their leaders, it turns out, is setting the expectations, having a clear vision of what success looks like, what are the roles and responsibilities. So we go more from being presence-based to being more workflow-based. And in fact, you could kind of see work in two ways. You could see the workflow going through an organization, and then you see the work execution. And teams are really focused on executing the work, but the leaders need to work on the flow of work through an organization. And then to get back to well-being, one of the biggest things I feel that leaders can do is model the behavior that they want to see. If you're working in the evenings and on the weekends, your people are going to see that, and they're going to work in the evenings and on the weekends too. So leaders really need to model the behavior of well-being so that the team models the same behavior.
So a responsibility that comes as well with all this from the leader side.
Absolutely. I mean, the leader is really the one who's setting the goals and then taking the roadblocks and the impediments out of the way. But as a worker, we really do have to take responsibility to get the breaks that we need to set up our ideal days to be productive for what we need. Because the individual knows what we need to be productive. And then the leaders need to model good behavior in terms of turning on and off so that people choose to do that.
But this circles back to the question of skills, I would say, both from the leader's perspective, because those are new skills that needs to be learned by the workers, by the leaders, as a team in general, you know. And the issue of the skills, especially within the frame of the future work, is something that we are also working a lot in another project here at Bruegel on the future work and inclusive growth. And working from home basically needs some sort of retraining besides the equipment part, which is also an important aspect. And I'm here not only referring to, you know, new hard skills, but also those soft skills that you were mentioning, like, you know, don't reply an email at a certain time, or ensure that you can have different ways of showing empathy with your coworkers. So it's a sort of repurposing the way we work and focus, right? Lizette, you have quite an extensive experience in trying to coaching and speaking to people about these new skills that are needed for that.
Yeah, our company does train people to help them work better together remotely. But the thing that I see is, you know, in the past, we've had this view of working from home or remote working as people in their pajama pants and umbrella drinks on the beach. And what we found during the pandemic is that is not what it is. Like, this is real work and it needs to be treated as such. And this kind of goes back to the theory of this is a new medium of work. And with this new medium, there is a whole new skill set that needs to be learned. And that is, how do we work online as if we are in the office together? How do we share information? How do we follow the security protocols? How do we know what each other are doing when we're all doing things online? How do we communicate? There's all these questions that we can go through and answer as a team, but it is a new skill set. And I think people just saw it in the past as like, oh, it was easy because you could do it in your pajamas, but that is not the case. A high performing team is not based on presence. It's based on results, and you don't have to be in person to get those results.
Scott, do you want to add something about this point on skills?
Yes. Well, first, let me applaud those remarks. I think that was really brilliant, Lisette. Well done. But yes, on skills, even before the pandemic, it was clear that a major shift in how we build skills was going to be needed. The other changes going on in the workplace have to do with the advent of artificial intelligence, roboticization. It was pretty clear that people were going to need to build a set of skills that they hadn't learned in grade school or high school or even in university. And of course, additional skills beyond those are needed to be an effective remote worker, which is exactly what Lisette was just driving at. So a shift away from the idea that you do all of your learning by age 21 or 20 something, and toward the idea that it becomes a lifelong learning process, I think was already in the cards, is even more in the cards with this shift to remote work. Now, here we do see some differences, I would argue, between US systems and European. On the one hand, I would say the US systems are a bit more flexible, the European ones a bit more rigid, but the European systems do some things really, really well. In particular, a number of European member states have very good apprenticeship programs. In the US, it's pretty hard to get a good job if you don't have a university education. In Europe, there's a much more realistic appreciation that there's a lot of need for skilled workers who may not really be suitable for university-type skills and who will benefit more from a more practical, practice-oriented education. So again, there's strengths in both systems. I think this is one of those opportunities for us to learn from one another. And this actually is one of the reasons why I'm so enthusiastic about being engaged in this EU-US Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future of Work. This is the kind of opportunity where I think we can add value.
Well said. I have one last question. We are going close to the end of this episode, but particularly interested in one aspect which we haven't touched that much, and it deals with geography and deals with urban impact of the pandemic. There has been, in the early days of the pandemic, there were some concerns, especially in the US, but not only. I mean, there have been also quite some talks here in Europe that workers would abandon the major cities. New York City would become a ghost town. This kind of apocalyptic scenarios were always some articles, let's put it like that, you know, that office buildings would be empty and they might be needed to convert it in private residences or else torn down. Are things going to play out somehow on this direction? Or if not, why not?
That's an excellent question, Giuseppe. And indeed, these apocalyptic projections were really widespread, especially in the United States. And I think there are reasons why we get this attitude in the United States. Americans, you know, going back hundreds of years, have been a bit distrustful of their cities. But in this case, all indications are that whatever has happened with the cities, it's been far less problematic and far less dramatic than these early predictions suggested. There have been some good studies looking at, for example, people moving from one U.S. postal zip code to another. So some work has already been done on this, and it's good work. And what it clearly indicates is that the change has not been dramatic, that mostly the few cities that are losing population in the U.S. were mainly cities that were already losing population. The acceleration has been there, but it's been slight, mainly in New York and San Francisco. But on a nationwide basis, really not so much. What we have seen is a tendency for people to move from central urban areas to areas that are a bit further from the core city than they would have previously chosen a few years ago. So what I would call exurban rather than a suburban migration. And that really makes sense when you look at the change that's taking place with work from home. If you're expecting to be in the office 2 days a week instead of 5 days a week, you can afford a somewhat longer commute. And that longer commute may be accompanied by a lower cost of housing, maybe a better quality of life during these pandemic days, also a bit less exposure to disease. So again, this seems to be the direction that we're heading in. Shorter moves, not a dramatic outpouring, but only a slight acceleration of trends that had already been visible.
Thank you, Scott. Lisette, do you have a word on this?
No, this is not my area of expertise at all. I mean, I noticed people leaving the cities, and I think that the main thing here is people want the freedom to choose where to live. And a lot of people were tied to location because of their jobs. And I think that's one of the things that's going to open things up a bit in the future. But yeah, it's still to be seen how much.
Well, from Brussels perspective, since we are based in Brussels here at Bruegel, one thing that it's on the radar and something that might play out more in the medium term is indeed the issue of the office space. That's something that is not yet super clear. The European Commission at some point made an announcement about reducing the amount of physical offices that is occupying in town, and what kind of impact all this is going to have in the reconfiguration of the workspaces, I would say it's still an open question. I think that it's still too early to see what kind of impact it could have. But definitely, it's a theme that is going to go on for a while. It's something that is worth to keep monitoring from that side. Scott, you want to add something on that?
Yes, I guess a question that I have for which I don't think there's an answer today is if working from home becomes common, let's say 2-3 days a week, one could easily imagine that the offices don't go away, but that office sharing becomes more practical. On the other hand, there's going to be organizational resistance to that. The employees themselves may not really be so keen on it. I don't know if it's going to become a popular model or not. Logically, it would make sense to save the space and for the companies to be saving rent by renting less space. But whether it plays out, who knows?
Exactly. That's one of the key questions indeed on this area. Having said that, I have to wrap up soon. So I would like to conclude with your final take on what to watch out for the future, not just in this final thing that we just mentioned, but in general in this space of working from home. And especially what would be, in your opinion, the things which might be common between the two sides of the Atlantic, and which are the things where the challenges might vary?
Okay, well, I would say work from home hasn't raised a huge number of policy issues in and of itself. Work from home mostly has been our salvation during the pandemic. It's the thing that enabled us to lose far fewer jobs and far fewer hours of productivity than we otherwise would have lost. So it's mostly been a positive thing. And other than the issues that I've already flagged, such as separating private time from work time and ensuring that people with caregiving responsibilities aren't long-term disadvantaged. Other than those, it hasn't raised too many concerns on its own, but it's important to remember that it's part of the entire work environment and that we have a lot of issues there that do require attention and somewhat different attention on the two sides of the Atlantic. We've had an increasing tendency toward gig work, things like Uber drivers and such. That's manifested a little differently during the pandemic, but it's certainly still there. We've got a very long-term shift away from the kind of full-time life employment that a lot of people expected 30, 40 years ago toward much more conditional or temporary kinds of arrangements. Very clear in the statistics on both sides of the Atlantic is a shift away from traditional employment toward non-traditional employment, self-employment. And there's a clear recognition that those people often don't get the full coverage of the social protection system. And there's where we see huge differences between the US side and the European side. Most European states offer a much more comprehensive social protection system for workers than do US systems. But I think one can also raise the question, does social protection need to apply only to workers? To what extent does it need to apply to everybody? To what extent does it need to apply to the self-employed? And the self-employed who aren't rolling in money also have social protection needs. So again, these systems are going to need to be rethought, I think. If you look at areas like, for example, pensions, the United States, I would say, does reasonably well. If you look at areas like health insurance, European systems tend to be much better, I would argue, than America. In the United States, you have huge gaps in who's covered. And the tendency toward work from home, all of these tendencies towards adapting the labor force to an environment that reflects the presence of artificial intelligence, robots, and all the rest, all of that, I think, is going to require a much more comprehensive approach to social protection and a much more inclusive approach. That, I think, is where the challenges are going to be, and more so in this case on the US side than the European.
Thank you, Scott. Lisette, your final words.
I couldn't agree more with what Scott has said there, especially on the issues of social protections. That is definitely going to be a big issue moving forward and something that's not going to be easy to solve. But I would say that for leaders and people who are desperately wishing and hoping that things are going to go back to the way things were, the train has left the station. We're not going back. And I would say that the future of work is not necessarily hybrid, but the future of work is choice. Choice for the individual to be able to choose when and where they're most productive, but also for companies to choose how remote they want to be. There are many companies whose culture is an in-person culture, and that's what they want to cultivate. And I would say, you know, more power to them, but it does need to be a deliberate choice. But I think that despite how difficult this new way of working can be, when we get it right, the payoff is huge because people can design their lives around the things that they love and not necessarily their jobs. And companies get a stronger and more connected workforce that is not dependent on location. So really, the payoff and the reason for working towards this new way of working is quite motivating, but definitely not to be outdone by the challenges, right? We have to recognize that there are challenges when it comes to this. What I would say, I guess, to the people is, recognize this as a new medium of work in your head, making the transition to this is not umbrella drinks and pajama bottoms, but it is a new medium that we need to train for going forward in the future.
Thank you so much, Lisette. And thanks, Scott, for both very insightful remarks on this. And this, unfortunately, brings us to the end of this episode, even though, of course, we are keeping our eyes open and keeping our discussions on the future work and on the specifics of working from home. I would like to remind our listeners that this episode is linked to the Transatlantic Expert Group on the Future Work, which is an interdisciplinary group of EU and US-based experts. The Sounds of Economic will keep following the project, and there will be more episodes dedicated to this theme in the months to come. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website, www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.